You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin could face billions of dollars in unfunded retiree benefits over the next generation. We'll learn about what the state and local governments are going to face in the coming years.
First, the World Health Organization declared the Zika virus an emergency earlier this year. The virus is spread by mosquitoes and showed up in the Western Hemisphere in 2015.
Travel advisories have some people rethinking trips to Florida, specifically Miami-Dade County, where Zika-carrying mosquitoes are known to be present. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the disease has shown up along the eastern seaboard, and there have now been 31 confirmed travel-related cases of Zika here in Wisconsin.
Well, the virus causes mild symptoms like fever, rash, headaches, and sensitivity to light. It's also known to cause birth defects. Babies born to Zika-infested mothers may be born with microcephaly, with abnormally small heads, often accompanied by brain damage.
Some women who are thinking of having children have found it difficult to get tested because of stringent CDC guidelines, which allow only women who are already pregnant to be tested. Joining us now to tell us more is a UW Health maternal fetal medicine specialist, Dr. Kathleen Antony. Dr. Antony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, Rob.
Well, let's talk about the group that we're talking about, women who are thinking about being pregnant, have been to areas where Zika is prevalent. How much should they be worried about exposure before getting pregnant?
If someone is worried they may have been exposed to Zika, the important precautions they should take before trying to conceive are, first of all, when they travel, the most important, you know, prevention technique is avoiding mosquito bites. And so that can be done by using, you know, the EPA-approved mosquito repellents, wearing long sleeves, you know, long hats that cover the nape of the neck, that sort of thing, or, of course, not traveling altogether.
And for women who think they might have been exposed and you know, it's hard to avoid mosquito bites completely, it sounds like it's hard to get tests for Zika. That seems like a group that might have a strong interest in getting those tests. Why is it difficult for them to get tested?
Right. So currently the CDC doesn't recommend Zika testing in asymptomatic, you know, men or women who have traveled before pregnancy. And so that means the state health department won't cover testing for that particular indication either. However, if someone had traveled to a Zika-affected area and had symptoms, then they would qualify for testing. Part of the reason for this is because the state health department is prioritizing testing of pregnant women and also of women and also of individuals who've had symptoms of Zika virus disease. They can; those people all qualify for testing. If someone wants a Zika test and doesn't qualify for one, though, there is some private testing available, but they typically would have to pay out of pocket for that sort of thing.
Now, let's talk about the Zika test. I suppose a lot of people probably do. I go in, I get a blood sample or something, and up or down, yes or no, it's a straightforward test. Reading up on this, it sounds like it is nowhere near that straightforward.
Right, exactly. And so at least during pregnancy, there's a couple of different ways that we test this. If someone is within 2 weeks of either the exposure period or they're having symptoms, there's one type of test that we send in. It's a blood test. And that test is called an RRT-PCR. However, if that particular test comes back negative for any reason, we typically would repeat the test about 2 weeks later. And the samples that we submit for testing include both blood and urine, because Zika can be found in the urine as well.
And it sounds like even with a couple different kind of tests or repeat tests, it's kind of hard to say, yes, 100% sure you do not have Zika.
Right. That is tricky. That's because Zika can have some cross-reactivity with dengue virus. And so particularly if we're sending the IgM test, that is one test where we can see some cross-reactivity with dengue. But overall, once we do the series of tests, and the RRT-PCR is actually generally pretty accurate.
Depends
on which test we do.
Talking to Dr. Kathleen Antony, UW Health maternal fetal medicine specialist, about testing for Zika. As I understand it, part of why the CDC isn't recommending wider groups get tested is that they don't want lots and lots of people who are panicked, think they might have Zika, probably don't, showing up crowding health facilities. Is that right?
Exactly. And a lot of the health facilities are actually burdened already. You know, some states have pretty long backlogs, even, you know, just for testing women who are pregnant or people who have symptoms, with some places taking, you know, a few weeks for the test result to come back.
And a lot of people with Zika don't know they have Zika. They might not even display any symptoms. Does someone who doesn't have symptoms, they're asymptomatic, do they still have the same risk of transmitting the disease to offspring or to their partners?
Right. And so actually, until even just a few weeks ago, at least all of the cases of sexual transmission of Zika virus disease happened in from men who, or, you know, among individuals who'd had symptoms. But it appears now that within the last month we discovered that there can actually be asymptomatic transmission of the Zika virus disease, you know, sexually between individuals. And so that means that of the, you know, majority of people who don't get symptoms of Zika virus disease, you know, they can continue to be transmitting it sexually as well.
Is this a concern you're hearing a lot here in Wisconsin in your practice?
It is, and actually travel, at least during pregnancy, appears to be much more common, you know, than we previously thought. We've had over 80 women who've been referred for Zika virus testing, you know, during pregnancy, and so it's actually not altogether uncommon. We're also not the only OB providers in, you know, even in this city, and so. You know, that doesn't capture all the women who've been tested, you know, at their own private clinic or at other providers here in town.
I know research is still going on, but from what we know, if a woman is exposed to Zika while pregnant or just before pregnancy, as she gets Zika, is it guaranteed, or what are the chances that microcephaly will be the result for their baby?
That's a great question. And the other issue is that microcephaly is really only one of the issues that can occur with Zika virus disease. You know, as everybody knows, it can cause microcephaly, which is a very, very small head of the baby. And the degree to which it's small can be pretty profound. But the reason the head is small is because parts of the brain don't develop properly. And so there can also be calcifications, issues with the eye. And in some cases, babies don't grow well, and there can be stillbirths and miscarriages. And if you take all of these findings together, it seems that the rate may be as high as 29%. And so all of these aren't necessarily microcephaly, but if you take all of the potential issues together, it may be, you know, almost as high as almost 30%.
Suppose a woman is pregnant, is diagnosed as having Zika. What then? Is there anything you can do to help her and help the outcome of the pregnancy?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have a treatment for Zika virus currently, but if a woman is having symptoms, we can treat the symptoms and give supportive care. If a woman tests positive for Zika virus disease during pregnancy, we can also screen the baby for anomalies by doing serial ultrasounds, and we can also see if the baby is affected by doing an amniocentesis to see if the infection has reached the baby.
Now, as someone who works directly with patients, I bet you're waiting maybe impatiently for research and developments to come along. What are you hoping to see next from, I don't know, people developing vaccines or tracking the transmission of the disease? What is on your wish list?
Oh, my gosh. So many things that I wish we knew. I think, you know, it would be nice to know exactly when during pregnancy the risk is highest. We know from data from Brazil that it appears that women who are infected at any point during pregnancy can have issues. You know, first trimester, we think that seems to be when the risk is highest of things like microcephaly. But even into the third trimester, it seems that there can be risks of stillbirth. But kind of parsing out when different things can happen, you know, would be one helpful thing. One exciting thing is research here at UW-Madison has actually shown that when primates are reinfected with the Zika virus a second time, you know, it doesn't replicate. And so that's exciting that there may be a vaccine that could theoretically be possibly developed, you know, against Zika virus disease in the future. And that would be tremendously helpful.
Dr. Anthony, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Dr. Kathleen Anthony, UW Health Maternal Fetal Medicine Specialist, talking to us about Zika testing. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a federal judge upheld Wisconsin's right-to-work law yesterday. We'll talk to a labor expert about that news and how the law could affect Wisconsin workers.
First, a new investigative report has discovered that Wisconsin could face a debt of more than $6 billion in the coming years in unfunded retirement benefit liabilities.
Those liabilities come from agreements made by the state with employees promising generous retirement and health care benefits. But along the way, not enough money was set aside to meet all of those obligations.
Jason Stein is with us now. He's a Capital reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's been covering the potential pension and health benefit shortfall. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, there's some good news and some bad news in reading your reporting on this on Wisconsin's public employee retirement funding. On the bad side, you found a lot of, and this is especially with local governments, haven't funded their obligations well enough. Can you lay out what's happening for us?
Right. So the first thing to point out is that these are the more than $6 billion that we found is at the local government level. We're very fortunate in the state of Wisconsin that we do have a fully funded pension system and a relatively modest amount of retiree health benefit liabilities. It's at the local level where in some cases you will see schools and counties and cities that are carrying some pretty substantial obligations on their books.
So what are some of the cities that cities and local governments and school systems that are most affected by this?
Right. Obviously, more than $4 billion is in Milwaukee County. There's more than $1 billion in retiree pension and health liabilities for the city, county, and schools of Milwaukee. Each of those entities, Racine is another place where there are really substantial challenges. If you add up the city, county, and Racine Unified School District, you get $686 million. Almost all of that liability is in for retiree health benefits.
How did those communities get there?
You know, one example that I give is the city of Beloit owes more than $100 million in retiree health liability projected. And in that case, police officers can retire in Beloit. They may be retiring in their early 50s, and they're eligible for the city to pick up the majority of their health insurance. Now, when you look at what that cost, the city health insurance for family coverage an individual is more than $22,000 a year. So when you're talking about someone that is not eligible for Medicare for more than a decade, you can easily get to a $200,000 or even $250,000 potential liability there.
What was the thinking up front? Is it something along the lines of, okay, maybe the pay isn't great, but the job's worthwhile because you're going to have these guaranteed benefits down the road?
Right. So, you know, in many cases, this was something that looked attractive to elected officials, and this can be as much as 40 years ago. I mean, in some cases, this is even happening in the early 1970s that local governments are choosing to offer this benefit to their employees. They may do it as a way to avoid having to give salary increases or as large of salary increases. And, you know, at one time, health insurance simply did not cost what it costs today. And so what you're finding is that in the communities where they haven't adjusted these benefits over the years, they can really add up to pretty massive obligations.
So they weren't expecting the health costs to be as high, maybe not expecting, lifespans have changed a little bit, maybe not expecting people to live as long, but were they salting some money away along this time to help defray those costs, or are there communities where that didn't happen at all?
Right. So that's the real crux of the issue, is that in the vast majority of cases, the retiree health benefits that local governments in Wisconsin have offered, those have not been funded in advance. So you may have a case where, you know, benefits were offered to someone for work that they did many years ago, but it's today's taxpayers who are being asked to pay that cost. And that's really what the challenge is going to be for local governments, especially given the fact that they can't necessarily raise property taxes to cover this.
Yeah, the amounts you mentioned for some different communities, these are significant amounts of money relative, I imagine, to the budgets of the cities and counties and school districts. I mean, what kind of impact would this have?
Well, I think a good example is Racine County, where if you look at it on a per capita basis, the liabilities that are being projected there would work out to about $3,500 for every person in the county. And obviously, I think that a reader or a listener can intuitively understand that that's a really substantial cost.
Let's talk about the time frame when this is going to hit. Is this something that's going to all take effect in a certain year? Is this something that's going to ramp up over time as these people who maybe got the jobs in the 70s and early 80s are retiring?
Sure. So obviously, this is not something that is going to come due all at once. This is something that will be over, you know, the next 2 to 3 decades that this will play out. Obviously, it's intensifying right now as baby boomers are retiring and starting to make greater use of these benefits. One aspect to this that's a little different than what governments owe in pension benefits is that retiree health care in many cases can be adjusted. It is not as hard and fast a benefit as a pension benefit is. So local governments do have some flexibility, at least in certain cases, to adjust benefit levels. But the other side of that is obviously in the last year or two, you've seen more turnover among government employees at the city and school level. And they're going to have to factor that in as well as they think about how they're going to compensate their employees.
For people, yeah, currently working, are they changing the formulas now so they're not making that long-term commitment to pay for health care after retirement for somebody who's maybe just starting on a job today?
Right. So in many cases over the last decade, you have seen that many local governments have already adjusted these benefits, and we've seen that intensify since this Governor Walker signed 2011 Act 10, which all but eliminated collective bargaining for public employees in Wisconsin. You know, but for whatever reason, some local governments have not made those changes. And so, you know, there are going to be communities that are going to have to grapple with this and decide, you know, are we going to pay these obligations or are we going to take steps that might reduce them or, you know, some combination of those strategies.
Talking to Jason Stein from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some underfunded retirement liabilities, especially health care liabilities for many local government units around the state. So you've started to touch on some solutions. What other kinds of things are people talking about here? Do they have options apart from just taking a big crunch over the next 20 years?
Sure. Well, I mean, one piece of really good news in this is that Wisconsin's pension system that almost all local governments outside of Milwaukee participate in, that system is fully funded, one of three systems that can say that in the country. So overall, we are in much better shape here in this state than, places like Illinois. But, you know, going forward, it's going to be difficult for many of these local governments, given that they have property tax caps in place, so they're going to have to look at, do we fund these benefits, do we reduce them, or do we, you know, and in some cases that may mean an effect on the services that they provide to their residents.
Let's talk about that state system you just mentioned, one looking pretty good when you look nationwide. In another piece, you talk a little bit about how we got there. How did we end up in such good shape with the state pension system?
Well, one thing that's really not very well understood about Wisconsin's system is that it is really unique in the country in that it is not what many people think of when they think of a traditional pension, where you get an amount based on your years of service and your salary, and you get cost of living increases, and it doesn't change no matter what. In Wisconsin, you do get a minimum benefit, but your benefit can also rise up from that minimum investments do well, or it can go back down to that minimum if investments don't do so well. And what we saw during the recent recession was that that system actually automatically adjusted benefits down by more than $4 billion, which helped to keep the system fully funded in a way that, you know, many other states saw their pension system, saw shortfalls open up or grow larger within their system.
As I understand it, you write that a lot of the uniqueness of that system goes back to one guy, a guy named Gary Gates. Can you tell us a little bit about him and the origins of this pension system?
Right. Well, so, you know, this system, and it's called shared risk, and the idea is that, you know, the taxpayers of the state and the public employees of the state share some of the risk, and it's not one side or the other that's holding all of the cards or holding the bag, so to speak, if there's a downturn in the economy. And I really searched for quite some time to sort of find the origins of this idea, and as far as I can see, it arose between a gentleman named Gary Gates and another gentleman named Max Sullivan, who is no longer living. But together, they came up in the 1970s with a way of, you know, having this shared risk system that's really different than any other public pension system in the country. It's really sort of a hybrid between a 401k and a traditional pension.
As we wrap up, Jason, as you continue to watch the story, what are you watching for next on Wisconsin's retirement obligations?
You know, it'll be interesting to see if the legislature steps in to take any action. I mean, there was legislation in the previous session that would have required local governments to fund their retiree benefits for new hires. So in other words, they wouldn't have to address a shortfall all at once, but have to start chipping away at it over time. So we'll see if that legislation picks up any steam in the coming session, you know, if it is reintroduced.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Jason Stein, Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the state's pension and retirement benefit system and how local governments could have overall more than $6 billion in unfunded costs over the next generation.
Coming up, a labor expert talks about the news that a federal judge upheld Wisconsin's right-to-work law. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. On this week's edition, what happens after one incident changes everything? 2 years ago, 43 Indigenous students mysteriously disappeared. Their families have been demanding justice. We hear where that situation stands today. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
Now, a federal judge has thrown out a lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's right-to-work law. Two unions challenged that law in court, arguing the law was an unconstitutional taking of their property. The plaintiffs said the law makes them give equal representation to non-union members, effectively taking their resources.
Merrick Masters joins us now from Wayne State University to talk about this decision and the effect of right to work on Wisconsin. He's the director of labor at Wayne. Merrick, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Well, starting from square one, remind us what right-to-work laws do.
Well, right-to-work law prohibits unions from negotiating union shop agreements, which require that employees who don't belong to the union at least pay union dues. There are 25 states, and added to that, West Virginia, that now have right-to-work laws.
And Indiana and Wisconsin, there are both states with challenges, legal challenges about these laws. Are there other states in a similar situation?
Well, I believe the one in West Virginia is also under challenge. And I think that you will find that right to work has been upheld over the years. I doubt that these attempts to challenge it will be upheld. I don't think that it's inconsistent with the National Labor Relations Act. That may be unfortunate, but that's the reality.
Well, can you explain this case brought by two Wisconsin unions that they were trying to make?
Well, they're trying to say that basically they took away their property, that they are trying to represent employees, and they have to represent employees who don't pay union dues. So therefore, it's not fair for them to free ride. That's the basic challenge. And over the years, the whole purpose of right-to-work laws are to allow people to free ride, that you can't compel union membership or you can't compel dues.
Now, what is your take on that argument?
Well, I think that that's something that's going to have to be resolved legislatively. I don't think it judicially that you will likely see the courts overturning right to work. It's been in existence since 1947, since the Taft-Hartley Act was passed. And as I said, you have 25 states now that have solid right to work laws. So I think the probability of that being judicially overturned is very small.
And you mentioned that in this particular lawsuit, the argument was that this conflicted with the National Labor Relations Act. You said you don't think so. Can you break that down for us? Tell us why not.
Well, the National Labor Relations Act, Section 14B, allows for states to enact right-to-work laws. And therefore, states have taken advantage of it. Numerous states, as I said, 25, have taken advantage of it. It's been upheld over the years. And I think they're trying to maybe invent some sort of novel theory that can overrule it, but I don't think that's likely to carry the weight at the end of the day.
If you say that it's contradictory that it's spelled out to allow this very thing right within the National Labor Relations Act, do you have any more information about what their particular angle was there?
Well, it's hard to fathom what their particular, going back to the National Labor Relations Act, but clearly the Taft-Hartley Act allows for right to work. It's hard to fathom what the argument is.
Now, the federal judge who upheld this law said that his ruling was influenced by a similar case in Indiana where a judge dismissed a challenge to that state's right-to-work law in 2014. And I think the judge in this case was effectively saying, well, look, this case was decided this way, so I have to decide the same way in this particular case involving Wisconsin. Can you explain how that works in this case?
Well, I think that, you know, they're relying on precedent here, and the precedent is that they've upheld the constitutionality of the right-to-work law, and they don't see a sound basis for overturning it.
And how similar was Wisconsin's case?
Well, they're both very similar in the sense that they involve union objections to the fact that they have to represent employees who don't pay dues. Basically, it's a challenge to the free rider problem.
We're talking to Merrick Masters right now from Wayne State University, talking about a federal judge's decision recently to uphold Wisconsin's right-to-work law. And Merrick, this hasn't been the only legal challenge to right-to-work in Wisconsin. In a separate case this year, a Dane County judge ruled that Act 1 resulted to an unconstitutional taking of union property, basically agreeing with one of the premises of this lawsuit we're discussing today. That decision was stayed. Do you see anything different about those two cases?
Well, I think that they're similar. I think you just have two different judicial interpretations. Wisconsin also adopted a right-to-work law that it applied to the public sector in 2011. And if you look at what's happened in Wisconsin since 2011, it's been, and if you go back a couple years, actually to 2009, it's been pretty dramatic, the decline in unionization in the state of Wisconsin. It's gone from 15.2% to 8.3%. Membership has gone from 384,000 to 220,000 in the public sector. You've seen membership fall by more than half. It's gone from 208,000 in 2009 to 102,000 this year. So there's been a very significant impact of right to work in the public sector, and I think that you will see probably a very significant impact in the private sector as the law begins to take effect. It was passed in 2015. There are some contracts, I would imagine, that were upheld until they expire. But once those contracts expire and you have no right to compel union membership or dues, then you're going to see the real effect take place.
What do you see when you look at other states who had right-to-work laws in effect sooner than Wisconsin? Do you see that declining membership in the private sector?
Well, let's take a look at two states that have done it in addition to Wisconsin recently. In Michigan, you had membership that has actually, in the state as a whole, it's gone. Membership has gone up. That's basically because membership in the auto industry has gone up during that time period. But membership in the public sector in Michigan has gone down considerably. It's gone down from 315,000 to 220,000 between 2009 and 2015. With the significant impact taking place in 2010 when you outlawed union security agreements in the public sector. And Michigan, when it passed its right to work law, did it both in the public and private sector. In Indiana, you have union membership that has gone down it's increased from 277,000 to 282,000 members, but there's been a decline in Indiana in the public sector, but there's been a slight uptick in the private sector. So the impacts have been different. I think Wisconsin has been by far the hardest hit in terms of its impact of right-to-work laws, particularly in the public sector.
Are there any broad takeaways about how states that have these sorts of laws, either in the public or the private sector, how that affects workers and their abilities to negotiate benefits, for instance?
Well, it's well known that that on average, pay is less, benefits are less in right-to-work states than in non-right-to-work states. What you see in right-to-work states is a much lower rate of unionization and union coverage than you do in non-right-to-work states. And I think one of the effects of longer-term effects of right-to-work laws is that they discourage union organizing. They make it harder to organize. Overall, with less unionization in terms of representation and membership, the bargaining power of the unions are significantly less than they are in non-right-to-work states.
Merrick Masters is with us now from Wayne State University, talking about a federal judge's decision to uphold Wisconsin's right-to-work law.
We want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the news that Wisconsin's right-to-work law was upheld in court? How has right-to-work affected you? How will it affect you, do you think? Do you think that this was a good idea to pass this what's called right-to-work legislation here in Wisconsin? Or do you wish it hadn't gone that way, hope to see it repealed in the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. We're picking up our discussion now about Wisconsin's right-to-work law with Merrick Masters from Wayne State University after a federal court judge rejected a court challenge by unions.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does right-to-work affect you, your workplace, if you're in a union? How is this affecting you? If you own a business, how do you feel about this law being upheld? All in all, good law for Wisconsin or bad idea? Call in 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's take our first caller. We've got Bob on the line in Claybanks. Hello, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for having the program. I'm just curious as to how the judges justify this as not being takings, of the union's
property.
Union's dues, It's you've got freeloaders basically that are taking advantage of what the union works to have for their workers as benefits, but not having them to pay the dues.
Bob, thanks for that. And Merrick, digging a little deeper, what is the legal underpinning?
Well, I think you really have conflicting viewpoints here. One viewpoint is that you should be able to compel dues in order to provide for fair representation. The other is that non-members should not be compelled to pay dues, that's an abridgment of their rights, and that therefore the National Labor Relations Act, as amended legislatively, has addressed this issue and established the right of states to enact right-to-work laws, which prohibit union shop arrangements that compel dues. I think that's the weight of the argument, that how it comes down now. I think if you want to change things, you've got to have to repeal right to work in the states, or you're going to have to repeal it legislatively at the national level.
Bob, thanks a lot for that call. And you said repealing it at the national level you think would be what would have to happen. Do you see that as a possibility anytime?
No, I don't think that that's a realistic possibility under the present circumstances, even with the Democratic Congress.
And why do you think it's not realistic? There's just not an appetite for it right now?
Think there's an appetite for it. I think that the reality, unfortunately, is that unions don't have anywhere near the clout that they did in Washington, particularly when it comes to labor law reform types of issues. They've been unsuccessful in getting any major changes through.
Let's take another call. Chris is joining us now in Fremont. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are we doing?
Good, thanks.
I got a question or a statement. I'm not sure, but with the reduction in the Wisconsin numbers, couldn't that be saying that these people don't want to be in a union? Isn't that making a statement saying we don't want the union?
Well, I think you could certainly make that argument, particularly in the public sector where you've had right to work for a number of years, and you've seen a considerable drop-off in union membership. It's hard to make any other kind of case. Unions, if they want to close the gap between those that are members and those that are represented, need to do a better job in justifying why employees should pay dues. That is a very hard-fought type of battle that they have to wage. And you get rid of dues check off, you have automatic reauthorization in Wisconsin of unions, which is another hindrance for labor. So there are lots of obstacles for unions to encounter, particularly in the public sector in Wisconsin.
And Merrick, Wisconsin's economy is still recovering slowly from the Great Recession, slower than some other states in some cases, although the news has been a little better lately. But I mean, couldn't you also make the case that the power of unions has been eclipsed, so why would you want to, you know, in essence, throw away money? Even if you support the idea of a union, it might not be practical right now.
Well, I think that, you know, that's the argument that unions face on a daily basis. They have to present their case to people on a one-on-one basis, and that's a big challenge. It's something that they haven't had to do for, you know, if you've been in a non-right-to-work state, you haven't had to do that. You could negotiate a union shop agreement and collect dues through a dues check-off automatically, but you don't have dues check-off and you don't have union shop arrangements in the public sector in Wisconsin anymore. And so that makes it very, very difficult to convert employees to members.
Another quick call here. We've got Greg joining us from Janesville. Hi, Greg.
Hi. Just a quick thing. As a trade union member, our dues go to pay for collective bargaining, which gains us a lot of benefits. Too many to, you know, go through here. When you bring in right to work, that's fine. I have no problem with that. But when people can come down and join or be put on the book in my local, and we have to send them out to work because of their right to work, but they can freeload and not have to pay those benefits, it's draining the system that the paying members are putting in.
Greg, we'll leave it there. And Merrick, just
I
10
think,
seconds
I think
or so.
That's an excellent point, and that's the principal case against right to work, that it's really unfair that you have to represent people who get the benefits regardless of whether they pay. And that raises a real issue of fairness.
Merrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Merrick Masters, labor expert at Wayne State University, looking at right-to-work laws being upheld here in the state of Wisconsin.
Opposition to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, helped propel Ron Johnson into office in 2010. 6 years later, the Republican U.S. Senator still wants to repeal and replace that law. His challenger, Democrat Russ Feingold, who voted for the act, still wants to keep it. The constant battling has left some voters wondering what to expect with their health care. Shemaine Mills reports.
For 13 years, Martha Campbell has worked at a Madison cab company. Before going into work, Martha grabs breakfast from a local cafe.
Could I get a sunrise muffin, please?
$2.64.
Campbell knows her dollars and cents, especially when it comes to the cost of health care. She knows what her company pays and what workers chip in. That's because Campbell works in human resources, so she's both management and labor. Campbell says the Affordable Care Act helped control health insurance premiums, whether people buy coverage on the exchange or get it through their job. She said premiums had been going up double digits prior to the law.
I think before the Affordable Care Act, it was out of control. Prices were going up.
Campbell says over the years, more of her paycheck has gone to pay for health coverage.
When I started, I probably had to work about 3 or 4 hours a month to pay for it, and now I'm working over 10 hours a month to pay for it.
Campbell also knows what her company pays. So much, it considered whether to drop insurance coverage for employees. There were two issues. One, under the ACA, the company would have to pay a fee. Two, she says it's unlikely workers would qualify for subsidies to pay for plans purchased on the exchange, leaving coverage unaffordable for some. There was no perfect solution.
The Affordable Care Act, I believe, solved some problems, but it created a whole new set of problems that we have to deal with.
In the race for Wisconsin's U.S. Senate seat, both candidates risk losing voters by changing or replacing the ACA. Campbell supports a single-payer health system, the kind Bernie Sanders talked about in the presidential primary. Feingold wants Sanders' supporters to back him, but he won't go quite so far. Feingold supports a public option, as he stated in this interview with WISN-TV's Mike Goucher.
I agree with him on many issues, and in fact, Bernie and I were holding out for an even stronger bill on the Affordable Care Act. We wanted an option to opt in, a public option.
A public option would create a government-run health insurance plan to compete with private plans on the exchanges. Feingold's opponent, Senator Johnson, wants to get rid of the ACA, which includes a provision requiring insurance companies cover everyone, including those with pre-existing conditions. Johnson says he would end the law's mandate to get insurance and replace it with free market reforms. He says that would give consumers the lowest price, best quality, and best customer service.
That was the promise of Obamacare, but we are not, we have not increased competition. We have dramatically decreased competition, which is why these insurance rates are just skyrocketing.
Voters like Campbell know that employers have been pushing more of the cost of health care onto employees.
Every year it's more and more. It's more and more and more.
But Campbell is uneasy with election year calls to end the Affordable Care Act until something better comes along. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.